Hello, I'm here during the lunch rush with Janice, who owns her own food truck.
Best cheesesteaks in town.
Janice traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for her food truck business. We're here where she needs us most.
They sure are.
We make it so easy for her to save, with customised coverage that grows with her business. Sorry, I just get so emotional talking about saving folks money.
Not this onion I'm chopping?
It's just so beautiful. Oh, yeah, nice, the onion.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at Geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious to buy chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Hey everyone, Amber here. So the last couple of weeks in this feed have been heavy. We've been deep in Nazi Germany with Horst Wessel and then the assassination of the American Nazi Party founder George Lincoln Rockwell. Important stories, but not exactly light listening. This week is technically an off week for Crimes of the Centuries. No new full episode, but I thought we could all use something completely different. Something fun. Something that has absolutely nothing to do with fascism, murder, political violence, or any of the darkness we've been sitting with. So instead, I'm sharing an episode of a grab bag collab show called More Like Ancient Aliens. It's an Ancient Aliens recap podcast, and I was lucky enough to be a guest. We watch the show, we mock the pseudo-history, we laugh at the hair. It's ridiculous and delightful, and after the past few weeks, I think we've all earned something ridiculous and delightful. Consider this a palate cleanser, a moment to breathe. We'll be back with regular programming next week, but for now, aliens. Allegedly. Enjoy.
Give me 1 second, I see my child out of the corner of my eye. Yes, sir.
Do I go to bed now?
Yes, sir. You come say hi.
It's staying in.
Say hi.
Hello.
Hey.
That's my son. They're saying hi. You can't hear them. All right, go brush your teeth.
Okay.
Tell them we're going to check.
Yes, right.
Brandon says he's going to come check.
Yeah. I know how to pretend that I brush my teeth. Run your thing under the water and then.
Yeah, I know.
Since the dawn of 2009, one TV show has dared to ask the most important questions about the origins of our world. That show is Ancient Aliens.
Yet until now, no one has asked the biggest question of all. Is Ancient Aliens total bullshit?
And that's what our show's about. Finding the truth under the nonsense of one of television's most popular franchises.
This is
More Like Ancient Aliens.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. That's good.
I like that. That's the bratty take, I think.
What would have other people been doing?
Variations on annoyed, miffed, sinister.
More like ancient aliens.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah,
I've always heard it this way in my head.
Amber, you're right. This is that show, which is a podcast about the History Channel program, Ancient Aliens. I'm one of two co-hosts. I'm Brandon R. Reynolds. I'm a journalist who has been in a cave once or twice.
And I guess that means I'm Toby Ball, the creator and host of the UFO podcast, Strange Arrivals.
That's great.
And we are very happy to have Amber Hunt with us. Amber, welcome.
Why, thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Amber is an investigative reporter, Pulitzer Prize winner, podcaster who reached the top of the Apple charts with Accused, 4 seasons, which is awesome, by the way, all 4 of them. And Amber is also funding important research into the truth behind aliens living underground, apparently. Amber, can you tell us more about this?
I would love to learn more about that. I have a lot of cancer research I'd like to fund first.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, we all have priorities.
Guys, today we're looking at Season 3, Episode 4 of Ancient Aliens, titled Underground Aliens. This one originally aired way back in the hallowed time, November 10th, 2010. In this episode, they dared to ask the question, what about caves? So we like to talk about why we're covering the particular episodes we are, because we're not going in chronological order. We're picking them willy-nilly from the 20 to 30,000 episodes that they've done so far. So why did we like this one? I mean, I think for me, it was about the fact that this one really ties together mythology from all of these different eras, because basically every civilization, you guys may or may not know this, has an underground. There's always a civilization that's got something underneath the ground. So they've always got ideas about what that is. So that plus geology, and then a particular 19th century strain of pseudoscience regarding underground civilizations that we'll get into later.
I love the idea that even though you're looking at underground aliens, sometimes they weren't actually underground, but people thought they might be. And, you know, it's just another one of these things where there are a couple of sort of compelling, like, what is this all about? And then 20 minutes of filler, which they're trying to like desperately like make a connection between something that doesn't really have much to do with underground aliens to kind of fill it out.
Amber, what'd you think?
You're talking about like the fact that Jules Verne wrote a book and somehow that's tied into underground aliens. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I learned so much that I did not know that some people believe could be true.
Are you talking about the ancient astronaut theorists?
Sometimes it's actually pretty rare that they credit them that precisely even. I noted so many times, I am a journalist. I forget what her name was, but there was an investigative journalist in this episode, which was great.
Linda Moulton Howe.
I have a hard time with some people say.
Oh, yeah, no. Some people say, the vague sources say, critics say, some ancient alien theorists surmise. There's a lot of people behind the curtain and very few people in front of it. So don't be scared. That is how they operate. They're just asking questions. And in this case, one of my favorite quotes right out of the gate is one in which geology could not provide an answer to some of these questions. So when that happens, you got to turn to the experts. The ancient alien theorists. This episode starts in Cappadocia in central Turkey with some very cool towers that were formed by wind and erosion over many years, and that early people figured out that you could carve caves into, and it basically created these early high rises, which is one of the things that happens with ancient aliens. There's always something really interesting that they'll blow by in favor of going towards something that's complete BS. In this case, I wanted to know more about how the people lived in those kind of naturally occurring apartment blocks. But nevertheless, we move past that into the old year of 1963, in which we're told that a simple renovation project on an apartment house or something led to the extraordinary discovery of a giant underground system of caves and rooms that's called Derinkuyu. Apparently, it goes down 13 stories into the ground, and there's 15,000 little shafts, rock rooms that could hold 20,000 people. Seemed pretty nice, I thought.
I've had worse apartments.
Yeah, we all have.
I don't know if they had dehumidifiers back then, which might be an issue. Yeah, Derinkuyu, there's some truth and there's some bullshit in the way they kind of talk about this. This was used for thousands of years, right? They date it back to what, like 1700 BC?
Since you cannot carbon date stone, it's anybody's guess how old Derinkuyu really is.
But it was actually used as recently as 1909 by people who were trying to escape, I think maybe the Ottoman Turks. Anyway, so this was over the course of centuries and centuries, was used to essentially hide from invaders. Where Turkey is, invaders are crossing back and forth as that land changes hands. There's a whole host of different groups that use that area. And during that time, it got expanded. So it wasn't like they didn't start off like 1700 BC and just build this huge like 13-story underground complex with ventilation. And then there's like a big like well sort of tunnel.
There was a food court. There's a Forever 21.
Sparrows.
Yeah.
Sparrows. Can you imagine how good that would be?
Awesome. A sparrow down in 200 feet down in a cave. That's kind of what the situation is that it sort of developed. I mean, I don't think they have a real sense of the order in which things happen, or like what particular period excavated in this direction or that direction or further down. But it definitely like occurred over the course of hundreds and hundreds of years. So it's not this sort of one generation of people just built this entire like huge thing to, you know, escape from the sky gods.
Yeah. Yeah. This is one of their favorite tricks. Amber, you may have picked up on this early on, is here's this thing that actually exists. We're going to present some normal reasons why you would build a thing. Could be climate change. That's an interesting idea. Could be, hey, there's a bunch of rampaging armies running around. The Phrygians. Of course, the Hittites. We all hate them. So you'd want to be underground. But what if it's not either of those things? And it's actually two extraterrestrial races who are at war overhead with their spaceships. And they may be what seems like carpet bombing the planet with possibly atomic weapons. Who can say? So what better place to go than to build some underground stuff? That's where the ancient alien theorists are taking us. Amber, how did you feel about that? Did you find that to be a theory that you could get behind?
What this reminded me of is that I used to have a source in Michigan. He was a medical examiner, and he would testify in cases about deaths, and whatever his theory was, whatever he had decided was the likely cause, method, manner of death, and all of that, he would testify, and the other side, who didn't want that to be the truth, would say, yes, but isn't it possible that such and such happened instead? And I loved this ME because almost every time he would go, well, anything's possible. It's possible aliens could come down, land on Earth tomorrow. But in my scientific opinion, blah, blah, blah. So that's all I could hear every single time. And I'm not sure if you've caught on yet. I am a newcomer to this program. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. Of course it's possible. I also think you're kind of underestimating humanity a little bit by jumping to the gods, but that's okay. Whatever you want to believe, it's possible. Let's go with that.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to think about it. It is that it has kind of a cynical view of people. Like, all of these amazing things could be people, but isn't it more interesting if they're people from beyond the stars, as they like to say?
Yes.
It's like people can't have imaginations. Like, if there are, like, you know, hieroglyphics or whatever that are portraying, like, people with the heads of a dog, it's not because somebody thought that would be a cool thing to draw. It's because there are actually dog people walking around, and this was an accurate representation of them. So you have to ask the question, where did those dog people come from?
And you do have to ask that question.
You're forced
to. That's just good journalism, yep. Right, Amber?
Exactly.
Ask about the dog people. So the Zoroastrians got brought up in here. And I think this is an interesting group of people. They were, you know, second century BCE, a religion that influenced Hinduism, Christianity, and a lot of others. They introduced a concept of dualism early on. So there's a good and there's an evil. And obviously religions that came after that, you can argue, pulled some of that, right? And the idea of a single god who regulates things in the sky. Speaking of single gods who regulate things in the sky, the Zoroastrians had a sky god named Ahura Mazda, who came down and, according to their ancient text, saved mankind from an environmental disaster a la Noah.
The great prophet Yima, he was instructed to build a kind of underground refuge similar to Derinkuyu by the sky god Ahura Mazda.
According to the sacred texts, Yima built a multi-level underground city to protect a select group of people and animals. Not from a flood, but from a global ice age. The Vendi Dad calls this the Evil Winters.
So maybe Derinkuyu was really just a very evolved and climate-conscious city of the future in the past. There's one way to look at it, which is, hey, this is a cool metaphor, sky god, etc. But what if it really was a guy from the sky who came down and made sure that they hid underground because, again, there's alien races that were having fights in space. You don't want to be caught out in that. Here you are. Amber, what did you think as you were watching it as a newbie to the show when it went from sort of historical images to all of a sudden a CG image of a space battle?
Seemed scientific to me. No. All right. So it reminded me, again, this time of a childhood memory. I decided at some point that the biblical flooding was actually the result of us as a human race and the earth being a ball of lint in a giant man's pocket. And his space-time continuum was different because he was a giant. So naturally, you know, a day to him would be years to us, and vice versa, whatever. He had decided one day he was going to wash his jacket. And that is what the flooding was. I have as much to bolster that as was presented in the show.
Yeah. Well, hearing that story, I think we're forced to ask the question, if that is actually true, is that giant man an ET from outer space?
Is that Ahura Mazda with a nice jacket?
I did a whole, I created a whole math problem. Like I had figured out, I can't remember the digits now, but I had figured out like one of our years was equal to one of his blanks. And if you on average want to wash your coat like every 2 weeks, then this would be the time that we would have another flood. And I do remember it would have been like in my 50s,
ooh,
which is within the next decade.
All right.
So heads up, everybody, calling it now.
You heard it here first.
This sounds like the beginning of a good cult. So we'll have to bring you back for one of the cult episodes of Ancient Aliens, which there are many. That's wild for a kid coming up with math about washing clothes. It's both extremely mundane and extremely cosmic, which I really appreciate.
Thank you.
So these early people, they were living underground as the war was going on overhead, a little bit like the London Blitz. The show has a decency to say, you know, but in recorded history, there were a lot of invaders that were coming through from desert raiders to Roman legions. And then it asks the important question, would conventional attacks really explain the complexity of these underground places? A guy named Brandenburg, apparently he had done some research for the Department of Defense, very ominous. He said, the cave is a grave to the well-prepared adversary, meaning once you find it, it's very vulnerable. So why would these people choose to live underground? It makes them extremely vulnerable. My question to that was, how are you somehow more vulnerable to people on horseback than you are to people launching nuclear weapons from spacecraft? Like, I don't know how the one is somehow a better deal than the other. But for some reason, their argument is, now you can see why it would be aliens, because they aren't going to see the bunkers underground, see, because they're flying around or something. Is that what you guys
yes.
got out of that?
I believe it was also that person who discussed how the doors closed.
Yeah.
And you know, it was only from the inside. It was like they were trying to keep somebody out.
Yeah.
Which wouldn't make sense if it was like a war invader, only if it were an alien invader.
You get it.
That part apparently is true, that those doors do only open and close from the inside. Again, it's one of those things where if you do like a tiny little bit of historical research, you'll find that in fact, you know, again and again and again and again and again, people hid from invading human forces successfully. That just kind of proves that you can.
I don't know, Toby. I think you're coming into this with some confirmation bias.
That's probably
true. You got to open up your mind a bit. As you can see, I'm being very open-minded myself.
I do cloud things with facts on occasion.
Yeah.
I'll admit to that.
Let's take this conversation to the next section. The American Southwest. Ancient aliens, as a rule, loves to bring in the native peoples of these United States and their various beliefs and traditions in a way that can be a little bit uncomfortable, because you see that they just go, well, these people are speaking extremely literally, and it gets a little weird. In this case, we're talking about the native people of the American Southwest. They name check the Navajo, the Zuni, the Pueblo, the Hopi, the Apache. People who, according to one of the commentators, Childress, says certain nations believe they emerged from an underground world into this world, which of course sounds like a clue for ancient aliens. And then there's talk of a storm of falling stars. There's reference to snake people who brought them underground and ant people they lived with underground. And then these physical traits that these beings had large eyes and fingers that could have evolved from living underground for a long time. So Tsoukalos, who Amber, I'm glad you got to see in this episode, he's the executive producer for the show and sort of its mascot. His hair changes a lot over the years, but it's always Tsoukalos' hair. He says of shamans and elders, before they were able to emerge out of planet Earth, they were brought here from space, raising the question that we've been talking about. Were underground beings actually aliens? And if so, could some of them still be living beneath the surface of the southwestern desert?
For decades, stories of encounters with UFOs and alien beings have been told among the people of New Mexico's Jicarilla Apache Reservation. Some of the aliens in these stories bear a strange resemblance to the ancient tales of the ant-like and snake-like beings from the Hopi legends.
You seem skeptical.
I might be a little.
Yeah.
What I'm most skeptical of, though, in that period, Linda Moulton Howe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Moulton? Yeah.
Investigative journalist.
Yeah. Kyren Redd, investigative journalist, Earth Files. And then the quote was, I have stood in front of what are called the ant people and some of the very strange large-eyed drawings on the rocks and wondered, am I looking at Native American interpretation of what today is called an extraterrestrial biological entity? There's so many questions presented and so few answers in response. But a good investigative journalist only asks the questions, does not actually look for the answers.
Yeah. The more open-ended, the better.
Pro tip.
Strangely, Linda Moulton Howe, I believe, won a Pulitzer.
No!
100% for a documentary she made on cattle mutilations.
Yeah.
Oh, God damn it. See, they were really good with this. Yeah. They're really good with this where they drop in some names of credible sounding people. Even if it's like tangential, like Neil Armstrong being something later.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then it's really not connected to it, but it's just enough that an average viewer might go, oh.
But she's like backwards. It's because she did one thing and won an award and then completely went off the deep end.
Okay. I'm looking up. She's a regional Emmy Award winner.
Oh, is that what it is?
Yes.
Come on, right. Toby. Fact check.
That's a Pulitzer. Pulitzer is just short for regional Emmy.
In fairness, I haven't won a regional Emmy, so.
I think Kevin may have a couple of them.
Amanda did.
Yeah?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. But I have not. So, I'm not knocking her award, but it ain't a fucking Pulitzer.
Regardless.
It was a regional Emmy for cattle country, probably. I mean, it would have to have been.
She's like right out there, like on the edges. And there's actually a story about, and we'll talk about Richard Doty in a second, about her being pulled in and shown like a special dossier by Air Force intelligence showing that they had proof that aliens had come and planted the seed to create human beings or something. And she's all jacked up about that. I think she may still be. Wow.
She's on a lot of episodes. We should say that she's definitely in possibly every episode. Certainly
so far,
many to most. She's part of the thing because she goes on the tour. She goes on the Ancient Aliens tour when they do like live events. I'm doing it all wrong.
I looked up Tsoukalos.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Tsoukalos.
Tsoukalos. I looked up his net worth. What the fuck am I doing with my life?
So we find ourselves in Dulce, New Mexico, or Dulce, New Mexico, Dulce, different. People say different things at the Jicarilla Apache Reservation. This is a real hotbed of modern UFO conspiracy stuff. We haven't heretofore covered a lot of like modern, like U.S. government cover-up stuff. It's been a lot of ancient aliens, but now we're getting into some modern aliens where, and I appreciate that the narrator, instead of just saying, you know, some ancient aliens theorists said, some UFO researchers and conspiracy theorists, like, had to allow for the fact that maybe there are some crazy people in this shit.
I have that in my notes, by the way. I have that written, and then that's some solid sourcing right there.
Exactly. Yes. You got to know. presenting evidence of a secret collaboration between underground aliens and the United States military, a fellow named Bill Burns, who then has a couple of titles after him. He's a lawyer, maybe a PhD. He talks about what a lot of people talk about when they suspect there's a conspiracy, which is if there's a military base and there's a lot of military traffic, like helicopters flying around, that must mean something's going on. And for some reason, it can't just be regular, you know, army-based stuff, military-based stuff. So he knows something's going on, and it has something to do with these vents that they find on the mesa, which apparently make noises or are heard to produce these groans and sighs. And did you guys catch what those were evidence of? Hearing those groans and sighs, the conclusion was pretty dark.
Yeah,
it was dark.
It's vivisection and experimentation, probably among other things.
Yeah. I mean, people are obviously getting their flesh just ripped off their bones.
Yeah.
This is serious. I don't know why you guys are joking about it.
We're not joking. We're asking questions. That's one thing we've learned.
I did a whole fucking podcast about some of this stuff.
All right. So here I have a question. All right. So I had to do the math on this because I'm watching this in 2024. And he says that these vents existed, but 25 years ago, they disappeared. They weren't there anymore. So that puts us into 1985. Because the show was recorded in 2010. We had recording equipment in 1985. So why did they not present any documentation of what they were describing at this point?
You think the government was going to let them just hold on to that stuff?
Yeah. You just gave Toby a pretty nice alley-oop to tell us a little more about the Dulce base. So settle back.
Yeah, kick back. Let me weave a little yarn for you. So, actually, in the second season of Strange Arrivals, I did several episodes about one of the aspects of Dulce and Archuleta Mesa. It's the story of this guy named Paul Benowitz. He's an electronics guy, and he lived right off Kirtland Air Force Base in Albuquerque, which is like this enormous Air Force base. And he had sort of put together like this homemade electronic stuff and was getting audio signals and was taking video of lights in the sky. And he started getting kind of freaked out about it. And he decided to go to Kirtland Air Force Base security and just say, look, there's something going on here. He thought it was aliens. He thought it was UFOs. And so he shows up and he talks to the security guy. Security guy gets in touch with this guy, Richard Doty, who is United States Air Force intelligence. And so Doty and the people who are sort of in charge of him, I guess, decide that instead of saying, look, you know, this is like a classified thing that you've picked up on and can you just like give us the evidence you have and just like don't think about it anymore? Instead, they said, fuck yeah, that is aliens. So this began a several year process of just feeding this guy disinformation. And he apparently maybe had some mental health issues to begin with.
Benowitz did.
Doty took him flying. Like Benowitz was an amateur pilot. And he said that he had seen some stuff on Archuleta Mesa. So he and Doty went to fly over the mesa, and Doty had had it set up so that it looked as though there was like a crashed UFO and that there was some work the military was doing to like clean it up and stuff. So they flew over and he kind of showed him this little tableau. So he kept getting these messages, this indecipherable audio stuff that was actually part of an NSA program. But according to Richard Doty, so they gave him this special computer they said was preloaded with a program that would decipher this for him. So it obviously wasn't. It was just kicking out messages that they had pre-programmed. And it was all this like really disturbing stuff about the aliens having a plot against humanity and that they had signed a treaty with the United States. But in fact, they had done that under false premises and they were going to go back on it, and that there was a whole sort of underground confrontation between the aliens and the military. And so he, Benowitz, based on all this, wrote a report called Project Beta, just like this crazy conspiracy thing, like this huge theory about how there are these malicious aliens that are going to take over. And he eventually ended up spending a little bit of time in a mental hospital because he had a nervous breakdown because of this. So it's a very odd period, but a lot of the Dulce and Archuleta Mesa stuff kind of stems from this disinformation campaign that was launched against Paul Benowitz. Benowitz, you know, gave presentations about it and passed information on to other UFO researchers. And it just kind of worked its way into the sort of UFO conspiracy zeitgeist. And it's still there. Like, you can still see that stuff.
Benowitz was a very good electrical engineer. And so he had developed this equipment and he was just pointing it from his backyard toward this base and was picking up all these signals. So the government obviously does get nervous, like, that he's picking up these signals. He's picking up transmissions that the NSA is sending around. So they get this guy, Doty, who has quite, he's a real character anyway. So you have to sort of take everything he has said, and he said a lot of this over the years in documentaries and stuff. You have to take it with a grain of salt. But it sounds like the whole idea was, if I make him believe that it's aliens, then he'll stop paying attention to what's really going on, which is, you know, basic U.S. secret stuff. And so, in fact, he sort of reroutes him to think that it's all aliens all the time. And in the process has now created this giant chapter of the modern UFO mythos, which is this whole underground alien thing. And this battle, I think it's called the Battle of Dulce or something like that. Anyway, where the aliens get into a battle with soldiers in the United States Air Force in and around maybe about 1985, now that I think about it.
And then they close the vents.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it's actually, Archuleta Mesa is a place where one branch of the military does exercises, and there are weird lights that do shine into the sky, which are used to help helicopters land at night. They're sort of navigation lights.
I mean, this all just seems like convenient excuses
to hide the alien presence.
Or obviously extraterrestrial activity.
Well, we are dupes. Yeah. We're doing the government's work for them.
You know, we always say we're nothing if not sheeple. Toby and I love to sheep.
You've got merchandise coming.
That's right. Right.
Hell yeah.
You're spouting it left and right.
Speaking of looking beneath the surface of things, Amber Hunt, everybody. Amber Hunt is our special guest. And if we're being honest, our sugar mama for this whole goddamn project. Thank you for being here and for letting there be a here that could be here that you're here for.
I'm so here for it.
There you go. Amber, I was a fan of you before I knew you, listening to the Seasons of Accused and really phenomenal stuff. I feel like you were sort of an early pioneer of the long form serialized true crime investigative thing. I can't think of a lot of others. I mean, obviously there was Serial, and then I feel like you, but you were sort of early on, weren't you?
We came out the first season, we reported through 2015, came out in 2016, which I think Serial was 2014.
14, yeah.
Yeah, yep. So we were definitely on the early end of it. And also we were the first significant newspaper produce podcast,
right.
Which I'm very proud of. I mean, that we had no idea what we were doing. We just knew the story was good to tell. And audio suited me. It turned out, even though I had been told early on in my journalism career that I had a terrible voice, that I should not go into radio. And so the whole time I was working on Accused, I was like, sorry, everybody. Sorry, I'm the one who narrates. It's my reporting. It only kind of makes sense, you know, but it worked out okay. Some people do hate my voice, but some people don't.
It happens to the best of us. Amber, don't worry about it.
Somebody called me that I had a permafrog.
A permafrog?
Permafrog in my throat. That was a recent review. I was like, well, maybe. I named him Earl.
Women's voices in podcasting
were destroyed.
It's just, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
You're either too sultry or you're too dry or you've got vocal fry, which vocal might never fry. Get dinged for.
Yeah.
It's, I just decided not to take it personally that probably I remind them of an ex-girlfriend or something they dicked over and they don't want to hear my voice because I remind too much of her.
Strong women. So you were doing that with Cincinnati Inquirer, right?
With the Cincinnati Inquirer and Amanda Rossman, who is part of Grab Bag Collab. She's one of my co-founders with Daisy Egan. Amanda was my partner on it from the very beginning.
How did you pull that off? I mean, newspapers I've worked for a few tend to be a little bit risk averse, fairly conservative, especially mm-hmm. when it comes to new things that cost money. Was that just all the stars had aligned, so to speak?
Yeah, they really kind of did. Right at the end of 2014 into 2015, all of Gannett staffers, we were all fired. We had to reapply for our jobs. And it was a bloodbath. It was uncomfortable. It was a terrible thing for morale. I got my job back. But it also was this like wake-up call. These people aren't going to be loyal to me. At that point, I had worked there 10 plus years with the company, not in Cincinnati specifically, but with the company overall. And so when this case about Elizabeth Andes, a murder victim, came to me, I was like, all right, so we're supposed to think outside of the box. What can I do with this that isn't totally traditional? And it so happened that we had a new boss at that same time because that bloodbath ended up costing the editor-in-chief her job because who knew it would like destroy morale, and that came back on her. So she lost her job. I'm sure she would word it much nicer. They parted ways. And this guy, Peter Bhatia, came in, and Peter was a multi-Pulitzer-winning editor whom I respect enormously. And at some point when Amanda and I were working on this project, we said, you know, if you want us to think differently about things, Serial just came out. This case is enormous if you want to dive into it properly. And I think it's solvable. Why don't we try and do it in podcast form? And if it weren't for Peter Bhatia, we wouldn't have been given the green light, but he did. And we were told the entire time it was a one-off. Don't expect to do another season of this. But then without any sponsorships or anything, it reached number one on Apple Podcasts. Back then it was iTunes, which was unheard of. Like the previous best received newspaper produced podcast had reached 27,000 downloads. So my goal was just to beat that. Although I whispered to Amanda, I was like, I really want to hit 1 million. And she was like, shh. And then we hit 1 million, and then we hit 2 million. Wow. And then, you know, it was amazing.
Wow.
And I got to do 3 more seasons, and then they defunded, and now I'm going to launch it by myself.
To hell with them. Yeah. I think that's great. When you were doing that, the style was still being invented. I mean, just as a genre of storytelling, there had, you know, there was long form magazine journalism, but, and, you know, there was radio, but again, there was just not a lot of it. Were you kind of just making it up as you go, or were you looking to other traditions and adapting it? How'd you figure out how you wanted to?
It was tricky because as much as I liked Serial, I didn't love every approach that they took. I still wanted it to be journalistic. And so I was really trying at first to keep it in third person and at arm's length. And finally, I had a eureka moment. Like I'd written episode 1 15 times. Finally, I was like, no, you got to do it in first person. Mm-hmm. People are on this journey with you. But I managed to do it in first person without it crossing any ethical lines that I didn't want to cross as a journalist. Yeah. So that was the tricky part for me, was figuring out how to keep it journalistic, following all the rules that we need to follow, while also being aware that this is a much more personal medium than I typically had worked in.
My memory, and I've probably listened to 350 podcasts since I listened to that.
I was going to say, like, this month.
There was like one particular moment where you were sort of confronted with some obstruction. And I can't remember if it was somebody in City Hall or something, but I remember that being like, it's like, oh, okay, this is sort of a very visceral example of these roadblocks that journalists run into.
Yeah, I think you're talking about the prosecutor
Yeah.
Who did not want to entertain the notion that he had charged the wrong guy, who was acquitted. So he had every reason to think, well, maybe we got it wrong. He is still in that position to this day. But I was able, like, through the reporting, I got in the habit of recording everything. And so I showed up to talk to this prosecutor who had been dodging us for a year. And there's audio of me chasing him down the hallway and following him onto an elevator. And I didn't know it at the time, but it turns out people really are interested in hearing what you go through. And none of that was done, you know, for dramatic purposes. It was because he hadn't returned my phone call. If he'd returned my phone call, then you would have just been hearing that. But yeah, I appreciate now that people actually are curious how we do our jobs.
Yeah, the process is really fascinating. I mean, I think that's exactly what you did really well, was you made yourself an audience proxy. Like, the smartest version of any listener is going to do what you're doing.
Well, thank you.
Is going to ask those questions. They wouldn't know that, because most people are not investigative journalists who are thinking in these ways. But you made it feel very familiar, very like, oh, I'm just along for the ride with this person, in a way that was really satisfying.
I will say that Amanda and I figured out early on that we wanted to avoid the red herrings. You know, there were elements that while we were reporting it, if we had produced an episode during the reporting process, it would have misled people unintentionally, because we were going down that path ourselves. So that's been one of our hard and fast rules, is that we don't sit down to write until we're ready to write. And you're not hearing it along the way, because I find it unethical to throw out a lot of alternate suspects and different theories that I haven't vetted yet. So that was Amanda, largely. She was a big, what's the word, supporter of that approach.
Feel free to pass on that advice to other podcasters.
You guys wrestle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We like to wrestle.
All right. Who's asking me what?
Yeah. Go ahead, Brandon.
How does it feel to now be on a show in which we're talking about a show that's 75 to 95% red herrings?
It is interesting. Like, it's tricky for me, because I have these ideas of what is appropriate. But, you know, this is not a journalism program, and that's okay. It is interesting entertainment. I do worry about some of the more gullible viewers. But I also like our Love is Blind recap show. So I'm here for the entertainment part, too.
Yeah. It's all fun and games until it starts to shape elections, I guess.
I think Love is Blind is going to do that first.
I hope so.
If you want to hear me opine at length about Amber's work, you can find the appropriate crime writers on.
It was called Shacuse.
We all gush about Amber's work. Yeah, I just say Amber's on the is on the Mount Rushmore of true crime podcasters. So I'll just leave it at that.
I'm feeling all mushy.
Let's get back to the show after that wonderful commercial break into reality, where we find ourselves in Ecuador, which we are told by this program is in South America. The land of the Shuar, who are headhunters, protective of their land and, you guys, its secrets.
What the hell's a headhunter, by the way, at this point? I feel like headhunter was something that, like, the British in, like, the 17, 1800s used to talk about people they consider to be primitive.
I thought they were just corporate recruiters.
It seemed strange that this previously uncontacted tribe would have those kinds of connections to set up C-suite types. That just sort of stuck out to me. I was like, headhunters? Like, what the hell? What are you talking about? Is that, what does that describe? Anyway.
I mean, it feels right from a program that refers to ancient astronaut theorists.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Repeatedly.
It reminds me of the very first book in the Tarzan series. There is a racial stereotype of, like, a black woman who, I think she's supposed to be the maid or something, and so she has these very outrageous reactions to things, but she talks about the natives and whatever this thing is, and she calls them man-eating geniuses, which I continue to think is kind of amazing. I don't know what it means, but it's incredible.
Now, that's a t-shirt.
Yeah, man eating, or a band. I mean, it's all kind of things.
Yeah, man-eating geniuses.
Yeah. So there's a Italian Catholic missionary. This is the middle of the 20th century, 70s. Father Paolo Crespi, who sounds like he was a hell of a guy. You know, you kind of wait for the other shoe to drop on this one. And the other shoe seems to be that he just sort of took care of the poor. And in exchange, a lot of the native peoples, including the Shuar, gave him gifts.
Father Paolo Crespi, he was loved by the Indians. He helped them without asking for money. And the Indians made them some presents.
But what was unique about the presents or gifts given to Father Crespi was that they often took the form of elaborately carved artifacts, some made of gold or other precious metals.
And this inspired Eric von Daniken, who is the godfather of this whole series, because he's the one that first wrote the book, Chariots of the Gods, that posited ancient aliens theory. And he says in 1973 with the book Gold of the Gods that what Crespi got was these people had all of this stuff from an advanced race that were kept in these caves underground, and they were giving him some of their artifacts. Otherwise, how else did these corporate raiders have such fancy stuff?
I mean, it's the most logical answer.
So then it talks a little bit about the series of events by which different explorers from around the world come to try and find these caves where this fancy stuff is kept. And, you know, they also say a lot of the stuff that he got, Father Crespi, was like, you can understand how people would just make this. But then there was this suspicious, these gold panels and things. So there's a Scottish guy, Stanley Hall, comes in 1975 to try and solve the mystery. He mounts an expedition to explore Taos with the aforementioned Neil Armstrong, first man to walk on the moon, who I guess figured, I've explored outer space, now it's time to explore inner space. And that was 76.
So it got shrunk down and injected into Daniel Quaid's body.
One hopes.
Daniel
or was Quaid. It Martin Short?
Martin Short.
Inner space.
It was Dennis Quaid shrunk down. Put into Martin Short's body.
That's what it is. Yeah. Scratch that. I fucked up the joke.
Yeah. I was waiting for a Miss Frizzle joke. No, you guys don't know who Miss Frizzle is?
No.
Yeah, from Magic School Bus. Magic School Bus.
Yeah, they were constantly getting shrunk down.
Oh, yeah, they get shrunk a lot.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah.
So they don't find anything, even though the narrator suggests that these amazing caves, I mean, they found some caves that could have been excavated by someone or, you guys, something, but never did find anything.
I wrote that down. Someone or something. Something.
Love that. So then we fast forward to 1991. There's a fellow named Jaramillo who says, oh, yeah, when I was a kid, I found these caves and I found these libraries with books made of gold, and the writing was like that on Crespi's tablets. So that set in motion a whole other search for this thing. And there's a lot of diving, which is fun. They found some cool underground columns and things like that.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Which again, you know, that's one of those. There's a couple of examples in every episode where you're like, I want to know more about that. Yeah. And then you don't. Then you don't at all.
What I would like to know, though, is they talked to... His name was Petronio Jaramillo, right?
Mm-hmm.
I might be mispronouncing that. They talked to him in 1991. Camcorders were abundant. I remember this. Why is that not recorded?
That's right. It seems like you're going back to the vent thing, Amber. You're going to have to let it go. Sometimes people were busy living their fucking lives. They can't be filming stuff all the time. They're just overwhelmed by the awe and the wonder of it all.
Maybe. I actually looked into Jaramillo a little bit, and his wife apparently said he was completely full of shit when asked by
shocking
people kind of trying to follow up on this stuff. He's like, nah, he's just a liar.
Who's the liar?
Jaramillo. He did not actually find a secret drawer, according to her.
No, he did not. Let's see. It was described as he entered a cave through an underwater tunnel and discovered a secret back entrance that way. She's saying that didn't happen? that a teenager didn't go into an underground tunnel and emerge to find a secret entrance into a cave full of golden nonsense writing.
Yeah. I don't know. He probably read Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe or something. Yeah, she doesn't buy it.
Do we even have documentation that he said it beyond this guy saying that he said it?
I don't know.
Because the next thing in the episode is, Jaramillo died.
He died.
Yep. He took his secrets with him.
And Crespi died too.
Crespi, they all died. Suspiciously, they all died. and the problem is all of his stuff vanished. But then a couple of years ago, there's a lot of these sleuths who make their bones looking for this stuff and went in search of it, a couple of these sleuths, and found out that his collection was not actually missing, but had been purchased by the Central Bank of Ecuador and is just stored in their museum vaults. They saw some of this stuff. They saw a lot of the so-called the metallic library that Von Daniken talks about. And it sounds like it was... You know, they looked at it, it's like, it's just carvings on kind of cheap metal. There was no gold. Or if there was gold, it had vanished, whatever. And that, you know, what was really valuable was actually the stuff that had been brought to him from all over Ecuador, which was these beautiful little artifacts that people had carved. But again, all made by, I'm sorry to break everybody's hearts on this, but made by human beings who have their own agency and culture and so on, and didn't need aliens. Turns out the true underground aliens were the friends we made along the way. Some say.
Some say.
Yeah.
Some say.
You're killing the buzz here.
And then so Hall, the Scotsman, died. His daughter is now continuing the work. God bless her. You got to keep the family business alive. Then, you know, there's some stuff about long skulls, which who knows? I mean, that's where you get literal. Like a sculpture has to be absolutely representative. They do not want to allow for any figurative stuff. So anytime you see a long head, it must be long heads here and long heads there. I mean, aliens are showing their long heads around.
It exactly matches that one in Egypt.
Yeah, he said it was identical, and there's no hemming or hawing about that, even though in my opinion it wasn't identical. They were both elongated skulls. I don't know how births worked back then. Like, there could be elongated skulls in the real world, especially back in the day when we didn't have such fantastic maternal care as we do now.
I think some places also did head binding.
Yes, they did. Yeah.
Which would also account for it.
It's one of my first memories was the neck lady.
Oh, yeah.
Ripley's, believe it or not.
Yes.
Hell yeah. So between the neck lady and your cosmic giant, in which we live in his pocket as a ball of lint. You really had some ideas about how the universe worked. Young Amber, you said to yourself, someday I'm going to invent podcasting, you motherfuckers.
Mostly I just realized that any theory was as good as the ones I was being taught at the time.
Yeah, that makes sense. Rounding out our little tour, we end up at the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico, one of Mexico's premier tourist destinations, the narrator tells us. With scenic beaches, a thick jungle, and sinkholes called cenotes, which I think are very cool. And if y'all have ever been, you know, around there, great places to swim.
Or sacrifice people.
And to sacrifice people, yeah.
But more than 700 miles to the north, there is another cave. One that may prove that the Mayan underworld and the terrifying gods who ruled it were not only very real, but thirsty for human blood.
So you have another riff. This episode is one in which they sort of tell the same story a bunch of times. So here again, you have a Spanish priest, an underground Mayan temple, which did exist, and some very cool carvings, et cetera, et cetera. The place is called Xibalba, the place of fear, which is Mayan myth and legend from the book of the Popol Vuh. And the question is, they find these caves with all this cool stuff in it. And they basically put the cart before the horse because they say, well, if this cave and all the stuff in it is older than the book that talks about this, then maybe it's the actual mythological place and the book isn't making it up, but is reporting on it like the first investigative journalists.
Yes.
Anyway, It sounds like it's pretty intense. There's a whole thing where they say, you know, you have to access this by going through a series of torture chambers of blood, darkness, cold, knives, bats, and jaguars, which sounds pretty intense.
It's intense, man.
I mean, I'm tired just hearing about it.
Yeah. But then when they're like, could these stalactites be the knives? It's like, dude, there's stalactites in a lot of caves.
There are.
I actually thought that was pretty good. Yeah. I mean, I thought they were like trying to talk themselves out of the magic or the alien version by being like, well, bats live in caves.
Yeah, bats.
It's cold and dark in caves. Yeah. And somebody put like jaguar bones in there. So, okay.
Yeah.
We solved this mystery.
We had some of our junior producers litter the place with jaguar bones right before we started filming. I feel like the idea that it was like this Popol Vuh, like it was like a novel that was written by somebody at a certain time and you just kind of made it up, kind of misses the point that generally these things are sort of compendiums of legends that have been going on for a long time. So it wouldn't be surprising if that basic story had been around for a long time. And then like if the idea is they set up this cave to like be ceremonial or whatever, just because it hadn't been written down yet doesn't mean that that story wasn't in the culture.
Amber, one thing you may have noticed about this show, which has been true of everyone we've seen and must be part of the DNA of the show, is that they have a very hazy relationship to metaphor, right? Like things, like the word isn't actually the thing, right? When you say cat, that is not the same thing as the animal. So they sort of have a wiggly relationship to, like, if someone writes something once upon a time, how do we know that that's not just, you know, documented reality rather than like some crazy story? And they use the idea of metaphor kind of conveniently. Like, well, in this case, I think they were being pretty serious about it. You know, Sky God, who's going to joke about something like that?
Yeah. I noticed that there were a lot of elements of the English language that they used in squishier ways than I would.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many sentences that began with if. I jotted one down. This was from the narrator. If Xibalba is real, were the lords of the dead also real? And if so, who or what were they?
Yep.
That is a 10-mile sentence with like four turns along the way.
They can stack the ifs.
So if this, then that is possible. And if that is possible, then this might be possible. Aliens.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of wiggle words. And then like a child, they'll pick up this concept and they'll construct a sentence and then they just sort of wander off.
Yeah, there's never an answer. I wish I could live in that world.
Perhaps that world is the world that is actually beneath the crust of the earth, Amber.
Could be. There's a lot of layers to that.
Y'all are transitioning us nicely into the last section, which is the North Pole, northernest of poles. This is a theory that there are holes at the top and bottom of the world, and that through those giant holes, you can access an inner world, which, depending on who you ask, is either a small Earth inside of the Earth, or is a series of smaller spheres, again, sort of like a shopping mall. You can go down one, down one, down one. It's unclear, but there's definitely a couple of ways to get into it. And this is the big reveal. It's like the biggest cave of all turns out to be the center of the Earth. They open with some loose talk about, science, like, it's some rocky crust. And then, you know, there's some liquid nickel iron. But then there's a core of solid iron nickel, which is magnetic. But what if there isn't? And in fact, it's dinosaurs all the way down. Is hollow earth theory. And that's the biggest ancient aliens, underground alien thing of all. Delightfully, some of these names are great. There's a guy named Clough who says, maybe there's a sun down there. There's, of course, Edmund Halley of Halley's Comet, is the guy who got this whole ball rolling by saying, what if there's all these spheres inside the Earth that could support life? And then this guy, Sims in 1818, who really, for some reason, his legacy lasted. I mean, he really was one that was like, no, there are definitely big holes you can get into the Earth. And Amber, as you pointed out, so much literature, not just the religious stuff that takes us back to the beginning of time, like where hell is and all of these ideas of like where you go when you die, but then so much kind of modern myth, Jules Verne journey to the center of the Earth, and like a zillion other things where people were really excited to go there. It kind of bears this thing out and maintains the kind of theory through the 1800s in a delightful way.
My favorite part of this section was how they introduced the theory. Again, I quote, could the frozen surface of the pole be hiding a gateway to a world within our surface world? There are those who believe the answer is yes. And what they believe is what's known as the hollow earth theory. There are those who believe that the answer is yes. Okay, good enough for me.
Who can really say?
Yeah.
But is there any evidence that such fantastic claims could be true? And has anyone actually been to the world within our Earth? Proponents of the Hollow Earth theory say yes, and that one of the explorers was no less a luminary than famed polar pioneer Admiral Richard E. Byrd.
And then, yeah, I love this. I couldn't quite follow this Admiral Byrd, but we've got an Admiral Byrd who was in the 1920s. He made some headlines because he flew over the North Pole. He was the first person to fly solo over the South Pole. Seems like a worthwhile character. And then all of a sudden they start talking about how hollow earth theorists believe that in 1947, a UFO took control of his airplane with a tractor beam, no less. And he was landed near an inner earth city, and the aliens there denounced America's use of nuclear weapons to him.
Yeah.
Now, he had a platform. He could have told this story. He did not. After he died, there was a journal of questionable origin assigned to him. And somehow this is a big part of this story some 80 years later.
Hollow Earthers will tell you that Byrd was a big believer in Hollow Earth, and that his whole mission after a certain point was to find this hole in the pole, which unfortunately is what they call it, the hole in the pole. Because that's why he was going there.
I call a few things that.
Yeah. So even though he was participating in this Antarctic exercise in 1947 called Operation High Jump, which is very well documented, it did not find any holes. They said he was on the other side of the world. He was as far away as you could be, getting sucked into the aforementioned hole by the aforementioned tractor beam. And all of this is because he said one thing once, which they take to mean he definitely saw something. And what he said in 1947 was, I'd like to see that land beyond the pole. That area beyond the pole is the center of the great unknown. And of course, people who wish to believe say beyond the pole means under the pole, where the dinosaurs roam, rather than, you know, the great unknown, like exploration and shit, whatever. Or like home, like I'm sick of this. I want to go home. Who knows? Anyway, that's it.
See, what I kind of thought was weird and sort of a missed opportunity for them was 1947 is also sort of the beginning of the UFO era. Yep. Like, it's just a few months between February 1947 and then July, maybe, is when Kenneth Arnold sees sort of the first UFO sighting
that's
really credited. So, like, I don't know why they didn't say, you know, 6 months later, suddenly you couldn't like throw a stick without hitting a UFO. And that to me seems like an easier line to draw than almost anything else they did here. But they didn't.
That's a good point.
If they want to get in touch with me, I can help them out with another episode.
Who's your agent?
My agent for alien issues. That would be Quazga, the alien from Venus.
What's the guy's name in the belly?
Jonah?
Oh, no, not that belly. I'm thinking Total Recall. The guy,
Quado.
Quado. That was
Quado. Yeah. Yeah. Quazga and Juhop were the two aliens that visited. I'm going to space her name, but it was a woman from Massachusetts who, pretty soon after Betty and Barney Hill, recounted a similar thing, but she was like a very devout Catholic, I think. So they basically, Quazga and Juhop, take her to the planets, one of which is clearly heaven and one of which is clearly hell, and then leave her a book, which disappears before anybody else can see it.
That's a bummer.
Yeah, that's what happens.
Probably in that library under the ground with all the gold books.
That could be.
You know, we leave our episode with a quote from the great George Norrie, the longtime host of Coast to Coast AM, the overnight show that explores all things paranormal. Not a guy who is necessarily unfamiliar with entertaining some out there beliefs. And even he said about the hole in the pole and all the rest of it, he said, you know, at the end of the day, it was a great myth. I mean, that's really putting a pretty fine point on. But this may all be a little bit of BS.
I did love that. I noted that too.
And that's it. Amber, congratulations. You have completed one episode of Ancient Aliens.
I'm so proud of myself. I did agree with something, though.
Uh-oh.
The end of the episode, they said, we've only scratched the surface of our planet's underground mysteries. I can buy that. I buy that.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Feels unobjectionable. Thank you, Amber. Did you have a good time?
I had a good time. This was fun. Yeah.
You did awesome.
Woo! I watched it twice, for fuck's sake. It's ridiculous. I know. You should make that pained look.
Yeah. Yeah. There's 19 seasons of this shit.
How?
I don't know.
And bonus stuff. And live tours.
We've
got a long way to go.
Yeah. I went to Giorgio's website. Giorgio. He sells t-shirts of himself, which is cool. But what really disturbed me was that the font on his website is both serif and sans serif at the same time. Like one letter is sans serif and the other one's serif, and I can't handle it.
Wow.
I don't even know how that's possible.
I don't know either. I looked at it, I couldn't find the font.
It's like Schrodinger's font.
Can I tell you my favorite quote of the whole thing? He's talking about a book of jaguar priests. There's a description in there. The road to the stars descended from the sky, and the 13 and 9 gods came to earth. What he emphasizes, I'm sorry. A road to the stars descended from the sky? Can it be more clear?
I wrote that one down too.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
Right there, we have a direct reference to someone that has arrived from outer space, and we have written record about this.
Yeah.
End of story.
It's nice when you get a smoking gun.
Yeah.
Would it be any more clear?
Come on, sheeple.
All right, thank you so much for having me. This was fun, and it was not murder.
Nobody died,
yes,
as far as we know. Or maybe some people did. I guess all the people that got sacrificed.
I mean, actually, we talked about a lot of dead people.
Yeah, that's true. Amber, let's pretend that this isn't your network. And why don't you tell us where people can find you and what you are working on now?
I will always say that the support of Grab Bag Collab is what I value the most at this point, because it doesn't just go to me. It goes to all the other show creators. So wherever this is being heard down the road, please support Grab Bag Collab. And I also have my Crimes of the Centuries podcast, which I have material to continue for 15 years. So hopefully I will. And support local journalism, because we in that field work really, really hard for not very much money. Just spend the $5 on a goddamn subscription. Thank you.
Here, here. Thank you, Amber Hunt.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Amber.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. More Like Ancient Aliens is produced by Heather Eagle Ears Wilson, and our theme song is by Nathan Reedy.
Next time, is the universe actually an egg? Are our eyes eggs? And did aliens give ancient Greeks early erotic technology? we will try our hand at Decoding the Cosmic Egg. That's season 11, episode 6. See you next week.